The paper was signed. That much is documented. The signature existed before anyone had a chance to call a lawyer, before anyone had a chance to think clearly, because a group of men had entered the room with guns. And when guns enter a room, the calculus of what is and isn't reasonable changes immediately. Radrick Davis, the man the world knows as Gucci Mane, signed a paper releasing a rapper from his record label under those conditions. Then, according to the New York Times and multiple subsequent reports, the men with guns left, and the calls started. There is something about that signed paper I want to come back to. Gucci Mane is not a man easily scared. This is documented too. He survived the streets of East Atlanta in the late 90s and early 2000s, when Atlanta's rap scene was being built on raw ambition and real violence in roughly equal measure. He survived a 2005 murder charge. Prosecutors said he shot and killed a man in self-defense during an alleged robbery attempt, and a jury agreed. He survived multiple prison sentences totaling years of his life. He survived a period of public breakdown so severe that the entertainment industry wrote him off, followed by one of the most complete recoveries and physical transformations in the history of hip-hop. He built 1017 Records from scratch into one of Atlanta's most significant imprints. He signed artists. He developed careers. He controlled product. And then, on a night in early April of 2026, a group of men arrived with guns, and the dynamic shifted. Lontrell Denzel Williams, Pooh Shiesty, had been one of Gucci Mane's signature signings. In 2020 and 2021, when Pooh Shiesty's music hit the rap ecosystem like a detonation, the entire industry took notice. His debut mixtape streamed hundreds of millions of times. His collaboration with Lil Durk, Back in Blood, reached the top 10. At 21 years old, he was being compared to artists who had taken years to reach that kind of trajectory. The 1017 Records machine had, by most industry accounts, broken another artist correctly. Then came December 2021, when federal prosecutors charged Pooh Shiesty with conspiracy to possess firearms in furtherance of a violent crime, stemming from a 2020 incident at a Florida hotel in which two people were shot. He pleaded guilty in 2022 and was sentenced to 5.5 years in federal prison. He went in at 22. The music industry moved on the way it always does, to the next emerging talent, the next viral moment, the next streaming spike. The 1017 Records contract, signed in the heat of his ascent, remained in place. The rights to his music, the percentage of his earnings, the structural terms that determine who profits from his name and catalog, all of that continued to govern whatever economic life his career had, even from behind a federal facility. There is a pattern in the music industry that predates hip-hop by decades. An artist signs when they are young, hungry, and unadvised. The contract terms that seemed manageable at 21 look different at 25 when the money is real and the label's share of it is visible. Record labels structure these agreements, knowing the leverage runs in one direction. The artist has the talent that the label needs to monetize. The label has the infrastructure, the distribution, the advances, and the lawyers. When those interests diverge, when the artist wants out and the label wants to retain what it helped create, the legal machinery is almost always on the label's side. This is not speculation. It is the documented history of how the music industry operates. From the Motown disputes of the 1960s to the Taylor Swift Masters situation of the 2010s, the contract is the trap. The trap is legal. That is the point. What makes the events of April 2nd and 3rd, 2026, significant is not that a music industry dispute became violent. That has happened before and will happen again. What makes it significant is the specific nature of what Pooh Shiesty and the men who accompanied him allegedly attempted to use the physical threat of immediate bodily harm to extract a legal document that the standard machinery of the law had apparently failed to deliver. They did not go to court. They did not seek arbitration. They went to Gucci Mane with guns and asked him to sign that signed paper. I want to come back to it now. A contract release in the music industry is not a simple document. It contains clauses governing future earnings, existing catalog rights, non-compete provisions, indemnification language, and often provisions about what happens if either party is later found to have signed under duress. A contract signed at gunpoint is, under standard contract law, potentially voidable by the coerced party. Legal professionals consulted by media in the hours after the story broke noted that the validity of the document Gucci Mane signed is almost certainly contested. The men who walked into that room with guns may have achieved nothing legally actionable because coerced signatures exist in a specific category of contract law that cuts against their position. Pu Xieste's alleged path to freedom from 1017 Records may be exactly as legally uncertain as it was before the guns came out. This is what makes the case such a precise document of how badly something went wrong. The plan, if it was a plan, was based on a misunderstanding of what a signature under threat actually accomplishes. Or it was not about the legal validity of the document at all. It was about the message, about dominance, about making a powerful man acknowledge, in writing, in front of witnesses, that you had enough leverage to make him do something he did not want to do. In the Atlanta rap ecosystem, and in the broader culture from which it emerged, that kind of moment has a specific weight that legal analysis alone cannot capture. This is not to justify what allegedly happened. It is to explain that the story is not simply a story about a contract dispute that went criminal. It is a story about power, about what happens when the machinery of legitimate power, the legal system, the contract, the industry infrastructure, is perceived as irreparably tilted, and someone decides to go outside it entirely. Pu Xieste was arrested. The charges have not been fully specified in initial reporting, but federal involvement is not unlikely given the nature of the alleged offense. Armed extortion of a contract release falls into categories that federal prosecutors have historically pursued with interest, particularly when the victim is a public figure and the evidence is a signed document with multiple witnesses. He had completed a federal sentence already. A second federal case, if that is what this becomes, represents a trajectory that is almost impossible to recover from professionally. He was 26 years old, Gucci Mane, one of the few artists of his generation who built and retained a significant business infrastructure. Rather than simply generating revenue for labels he didn't control, cooperated with law enforcement. The paper he signed likely goes into evidence. Whether it will ever govern anything beyond the prosecution's exhibit list is a question for courts. The question that sits at the center of this is not whether what Pu Xieste allegedly did was wrong. Under any definition, walking into someone's home or office with weapons and demanding a signature is not a gray area. The question is, what system produced the conditions in which that felt like an option? Record contracts that trap artists for years, sometimes decades, after their commercial peak. An industry that monetizes creative genius through structures that consistently favor the capital side of the equation. A culture in which recourse to force when legitimate systems fail is not unusual, is sometimes celebrated, and carries its own internal logic that exists entirely outside the one that will now decide this case in federal court. The paper was signed. It may not be worth anything in court. Pu Xieste is in custody. Gucci Mane's catalog remains under his label's umbrella. The cycle, talent signed young, talent and label split, talent seeking exit through whatever means available, continues, as it has continued in American music for 70 years. The only question that remains genuinely open is this. When a system is structurally designed to benefit one party at the expense of another, and that other party uses force to circumvent it, who bears responsibility for what happens next? The person who committed it, or the system that made it feel like the only available door?